two of them all. And at the end of business tomorrow, we'll be sending them away with specific guidance on how to deal with all of these. Obviously, that makes time a very important issue for us, so we need to move. We'll need to move along, and I may remind us of that from time to time as we go along. So, this is a discussion between the staff and the commission. There will be no public participation, so I'm sure that will be difficult, but you, obviously, the public has had 5 weeks of public testimony plus all kinds of opportunity to supply written comments. It's now the commission's turn to have something to say. So we would appreciate it if there were no public comments. As much as you're going to want to, I'm sure. There will be opportunity to comment on what we're doing today at a later time. We'll be offering, once this staff report based on this meeting is written up, that we'll be going out for public comment. So you're obviously going to have numerous additional opportunities to make review our work for us, tell us how good we did. So, with that, I'm going to ask the staff if they have any comments before we begin on the programs. I believe Aga had a few things she wanted to tell us. So.
Thank you, Chair Harvey. Good morning, everybody. It's great to be here. I do just want to make a couple of brief comments with respect to the recommendations document that you received last week. As you know by now, having reviewed it, these staff and consultant recommendations are not in the form of findings of fact and conclusions of law, which is the form that a staff recommendation typically comes to you. And this is intentionally not a decision document. We are neither recommending approval or denial of this concept plan as it has been presented by Plum Creek. Rather, per the commission's instruction at the end of the January hearings, we have presented for your consideration a set of recommendations that, if accepted, we believe would result in a concept plan that meets all of the review criteria. One other point with respect to this document, while we haven't presented the rationale for how we feel these recommendations would meet the review criteria, I hope it goes without saying that the framework within which we've developed these recommendations are encompassed and integral to the review criteria and are based on the relevant review criteria for concept plans. And I just want to note that we would be happy and we are ready to share our thought process on any of these recommendations at any time along the way if you wish to engage us in that discussion. The last thing I want to mention very quickly is we want to bring to your attention several errors that we have discovered since the release of this document, and I'd like to ask Ron to quickly walk through those errors before we begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. Despite our best efforts, there were a few things here that we wanted to bring your attention to. First is on page 13. The first paragraph there is starting with the Commission would also solicit is a verbatim, at least from what we can tell, repeat of that same paragraph that appeared on page 12. We didn't put it there twice to make sure you read it. Copy function or the cut function didn't, I guess, work. So that's number one. No meaning there. On a more substantive basis, on page 113, this is a discussion of additional plan elements. It's discussing the vehicular road access easements that Plum Creek is offering as an additional plan element, and the staff recommendations. It goes to the sequencing. There were two directions that were misstated in that. In the on the far right column, in the second bullet, it should read, concurrent with LURC subdivision development approval for the first 200 residential and or resort accommodation units on the west, strike east, side of Moosehead Lake, execute easements for the following roads. And then the next bullet down, it has that same directional error. It should say on the west side of Moosehead Lake again. And as we walk you through this, hopefully the logic of how that's set up will come through. Two more. On page 116, this is a set of recommendations, a discussion on the Community Stewardship Fund. And under the table starting two, funding for CSF activities, there was a substantive omission there. As you will remember, Plum Creek is proposing that the Community Stewardship Fund be financed or funded by a donation or fee of 2% on the 975 residential dwelling units, and then a 1% fee on resale of those units. The staff had intended in its recommendation, and I have text for a new recommendation, to also include to you a recommendation that either that fee or an alternative approach be added to the individually owned units that would also be in the resort, so that that fee for would apply in one form or another. And I want to put this up in the screen, but just to explain it, that fee or an alternative approach would apply not just to the 975 residential dwelling units, but any of the resort accommodations that essentially look and feel like individual ownership as well, not the short-term accommodation units. And let me just put this up so I can just quickly walk you through it. I have copies of this that I can either pass on now or we get to. It's shown in track changes or strikeout form. So the important addition is in the second half. For those resort accommodation units that are individually owned, the same funding amount, mechanism, and distribution / allocation should be required for these units as well, unless, one, the long-term development plan for the resort proposes and the commission approves an equivalent alternative plan for the resort to address these recreation, housing, and wildlife needs, or two, the long-term plan demonstrates that the resort and these units will not contribute to the needs that these three funds are addressing. And we can explain this when we get through it. But that was an omission in our recommendations, and I apologize for that. The last piece is on that same page, and it's really a pure formatting issue. Number three on that page, the land donations to BPL, and number four, the affordable housing, are incorrectly set up in table format as subpoints or sub-elements of the Community Stewardship Fund, and they're not. They weren't presented that way in the Plum Creek recommendation or the Plum Creek proposal. They're standalone additional plan elements, and so they should just be formatted so that they're taken out of the overarching table, Community Stewardship Fund, and just set up as an additional plan element, independent land donations to BPL, and an additional plan element, independent affordable housing. And if you go back to the cover page, that's there. So with apologies from Evan and Og and I, those are the errors and omissions.
Okay, thank you, Ron. Jerry, do you have any comments at this point?
No.
Counsel, you're ready to go. Okay. All right. If that's the case, I think what we're going to start right at the top with the proposed development areas and kind of work through those one at a time.
Thanks.
If it would be helpful, what I could do just to get you familiar with the structure and organization of these recommendations is I could just spend a couple of minutes guiding you through the architecture of the Beaver Cove recommendation, if you feel that would be helpful. Not necessarily talking about the substance, which I'm sure you have read, but rather the flow of the document.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. As you'll see, all of the development area-specific recommendations in this document are set up in table form and categorized by elements that we feel are key elements of the proposal. And next to each of those elements is a summary of Plum Creek's current concept plan proposal and then an outline of the staff recommendations related to that element. So, for example, starting on page 3 with the Beaver Cove development area, we have outlined the 5 categories of unit types that Plum Creek is proposing within these development areas. And as you know, some of the areas are exclusively intended for residential development. Others are for resort development. And those are categorized into those 5 types. Going down the list quickly, there's the next line deals with the ability to transfer in additional units, specifically additional residential units, up to the 975-unit residential cap proposed by Plum Creek. And in the case of Beaver Cove, you will see that Plum Creek is proposing that this is an uncapped area that could be a potential receiving area for a portion of those 975 units. Going down to the next line, there's a discussion or a description of the approximate size and configuration of the development areas and any changes we are recommending with respect to that. And then a description of the land use zoning or permitted uses within that development area. On page 4, you will see a description of what development review process subsequent to concept plan approval would be in place or is being proposed. And then there is a line item for what might happen to any lands that are not developed within the 30-year term of the plan within this development area and how that undeveloped land is dealt with in the current proposal and within our recommendations. So these these core elements are repeated throughout each of the development areas, with some development areas having additional line items that are specific to those areas. So any questions on kind of the flow of the document?
I'm looking for a recommendation, I guess, from the staff on this. One thing I found when going through this format, which, by the way, I find very easy to go through and read. I mean, it's straightforward with the tables and everything. I think you did a great job of making something very complicated a lot easier for us to review. But for example, when we get to the land use zoning, and you look at the recommendation where it is to combine 2 zones, mm-hmm. I mean, should we have that conversation about that that concept or that recommendation in this conversation about this first district, or should we wait till later? It also is relevant to disposition of undeveloped land after 30-year term. And We get into that, and then it's applicable in many of the other districts. And
that's a great point. The way this document is structured is it does have a number of cross-references to some broader development issues that have been highlighted by the staff. And one of them is, of course, the permitted uses and the zoning structure, as well as the disposition of excess lands, which are more holistically addressed later in the document. On the zoning side, for example, that discussion begins on page 47, and there are some broad planning and design elements that are discussed starting on page 56 that really are flow through the development-specific issues. And I would suggest that at any point where you have an issue or want to discuss that at a specific level at each development area, you should do so and then circle back and step back when you get to the general development issues and look at it more comprehensively at that point.
Aga, could I ask a follow-on question to that? And that is, it appears that Plum Creek has offered some some new zones, and then you had the staff has taken those zones and kind of combined them into one zone. It might be helpful if you just gave us a little discussion on that whole thing, so that we know. And I have questions too, like where do the H and where do the M come from?
Right.
You can work that in.
Okay. Yeah, I would be happy to give you an overview of our thinking on the land use zoning because it is a flow-through issue. If you can go to page 48 of the recommendations document, you will see an overview of the recommendations with respect to the development zoning, the management zoning, and the protection zoning. And I'm assuming, Steve, that you're in particular looking for an explanation of the development zoning right now, so that's what I'll focus in on. Basically, what we are recommending, starting on page 49, is on the residential development side, consolidating the two residential zones that Plum Creek is proposing into one residential zone that in some areas prohibits commercial development and in other areas allows commercial development of a limited nature by special exception. So if you look on page 49 on the left-hand side, in the left-hand column, you will see a description of the two residential zones that Plum Creek is proposing, as well as the mixed-use development zone, that DGN3, that is included as kind of like a floating zone within some of the development areas. And on the right-hand side, you see that we are recommending creating one zone that accommodates a range of residential and mixed-use development in different areas. Okay, so for example, reflecting back to Beaver Cove, this is where the reference to the DMHRS1 is.
DMH mixed housing.
Moosehead.
Moosehead. I didn't know.
We simply wanted to distinguish it from the other residential zones in the LURC jurisdiction. So no other reference to mixed housing there. But it is a mixed housing zone. In other words, it would permit a range of residential uses from single-family dwellings to duplexes and multifamily dwellings, as well as affordable housing. And in some areas, such as at the Braswell Lake South Peninsula, for example, this zone would also allow for some limited scale commercial facilities and uses by special exception. If you flip to the next page, you will see that this describes our recommendations with respect to the resort-related zone proposed by Plum Creek. And here, Plum Creek is proposing one zone, the DGN 2M zone, that would apply to a portion of Lily Bay and to the Big Moose Mountain development area. And here we are recommending actually dividing this zone into three separate land use zones, one that would accommodate residential as well as resort-related development, for example, at Lily Bay and at Moose Bay, but would not require resort development. And then on page 51, the other zone would be a resort development zone for the Big Moose Mountain area that would require resort development. And we can go into the details of that when we get to discussing Big Moose Mountain. And then the third resort-related zone would be to capture the, quote, low-impact development that is being proposed at Big Moose Mountain on the Indian Pond shoreline, as well as on Lily Bay Mountain. And we are recommending a separate land use zone for this area that would restrict uses to primitive resort accommodations comparable to sporting camps.
Going back to the residential zones for 1 second and Commissioner Hilton's question, tying what Aga just explained to you to Beaver Cove, for instance. Plum Creek had proposed at Beaver Cove a DRS-3 zone, which would mean for the 30-year concept plan, the only thing that could be constructed in Beaver Cove was single-family residences. That's what the proposal was, and that's what you were being asked to approve. So what Aga is saying is that we are suggesting that while the developer can always maintain the ability through restrictive covenants on a particular development to have only single-family houses, to have a zone for 30 years that says thou shalt do nothing but single-family homes and are prohibited did not make sense to us, and that there should be flexibility if some kind of multifamily was more appropriate, plus very limited, as Aga said, commercial uses that are scaled depending on each development. So that's the connection between on the Beaver Cove issue, and obviously you can talk a lot more about it, but taking the proposed change to one zone with different approaches from what was there.
My only other overriding question is that if I were to walk up to the front door of a house and knock on the door, and would I know whether that house, just by looking at it, was one of the 975 single-family homes, or whether it was one of the who knows how many resort single-family units? Is there any difference in construction style or anything else of those?
We are recommending that there be a difference in unit type only at the Big Moose Mountain Resort Zone, in that a percentage of those units ought to be short-term resort accommodations, in which case you may be able to distinguish it not necessarily by looking at the structure, but by looking at the deed that goes with that structure.
I understand that difference, but there are a lot of them that are apparently can be single-family homes.
That's
and
right.
Would they look any different than the 975?
No, they would not.
Okay, thank you.
I do want to give Evan an opportunity to also talk to you about the hierarchy of commercial uses that we had envisioned in each of these zones. I think that would be useful as context.
I have a couple of questions about the intensity and type of uses allowed in each zone. Do you want to address that now, or do you want to wait until it comes in the presentation itself?
We can certainly address it now if you wish.
What do you think would be most useful for us, to do it now?
Since we're on the topic, I think it's a natural progression.
Okay, then again, following up on Steve's question, could you sort of give us examples?
Yeah, I'm going to ask Evan to do that.
Uses in each one of these zones,
certainly.
Not the residential as well as the resort and in the commercial zone.
Yes, good morning. I haven't had a chance
good
to
morning.
Say that. One more big picture rationale to add to Aga's and Ron's is that whereas the Plum Creek proposal created a hierarchy of zones. Sometimes in zoning you think of hierarchies of zones where the most exclusive use is at the top of the pyramid and the most open zone with the most open to use is at the bottom of that pyramid. As is not unusual, in zoning schemes, Plum Creek envisioned this pyramid to be based on residential, so that there was a relatively exclusive residential zone at the top where you could only do single-family homes, basically. And then as you went down the pyramid to a different residential, to commercial, to resort, the numbers and types of uses expanded as you went down that hierarchy. As Ron indicated, we could not find a strong public purpose in thinking of exclusivity residentially in any one place over another. And so we've switched this hierarchy to more of a commercial hierarchy, where you have at the most restrictive zone is what Aga referred to as the primitive resort, where there's only one thing you can do there, basically a sporting camp type of thing. And then at the very bottom of the pyramid, the most expansive is the what is called the resort zone, or RT is the initial given to it, zone where there is a fairly wide open range of uses that would be allowable there. And in between, there are different levels of non-residential activity that could occur. To answer your question, Commissioner, in the primitive recreation resort zone, very little can happen there of any intensity. It's strictly limited to a sporting camp kind of set of uses, 10,000 square feet gross total allowed, no building more than 2,000 square feet in size. Then you come to the residential development zone, which is styled D Moosehead RS1, in which there are several of the zones that will be exclusively residential, but within that residentially, it doesn't matter to us as a matter of public policy as to whether those are single family homes or duplexes or townhouses or multifamily. The market and the developer will probably make it single family homes, but as a matter of public policy, we are agnostic about that, as long as they can get septic system permits and meet all the other standards. There could also be in those places certain civic uses, such as if there had to be a satellite fire station or something like that there, but there could not be commercial uses. And those zones include, for example, Upper Wilson.
Excuse me, just before we go on here, with regard to the residential resort optional development zone,
yep,
you referred to that as DMHRS1. On page 50, it's RS2.
It should be RS2.
It should be RS2 or RS1?
2.
Okay, because when we go back to page 3, the Beaver Cove development area, it references RS1. So that's correct.
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
Yep. So let me continue down the hierarchy here.
I'm a little confused.
Okay.
Is the residential resort optional development zone RS2 or RS1?
RS2.
Okay, what is RS1?
RS1 is a residential development zone. It is just residential.
Okay.
But there are two flavors of this RS1. One flavor is it's just residential, but with the capacity to build in some public uses as may be necessary. And that's places like Upper Wilson and Long Pond and so forth.
Okay.
And then the second flavor of residential development, or RS1, would allow places like Rockwood, Blue Ridge, or South Brassway, where there is a critical mass of residential development proposed, it would allow some neighborhood-scale commercial uses so that people could get some basic goods and services, the quart of milk, the newspaper, the ice cream cone, a walking distance away or a very short drive away.
And how, on a map, will we designate the difference between those two?
Well, they will. It'll be easy to code them on a map, but it'll be right in the language of the.
Will they both be RS1s?
They'll both be RS1s, with the exception that in a few of the places, by special exception, some of these neighborhood scale, limited business uses would be allowed.
But it seems as though you'd need another number.
You wouldn't need another number. The way that we do this in current zoning is by listing certain additional uses under the by special exception category.
Okay.
So, for example, this would say, in the following areas, and list the areas, Route 6 and 15, Rockwood, South Brassway, the following additional uses are allowed by special exception, and then the neighborhood scale uses that we are referring to would be listed in that hierarchy.
I guess I'm jumping ahead and thinking that this may be the makings of the new Moosehead plan, in which case, rather than having to list each of the areas where you could do different things in an RS1, you might want to have an RS1A.
I think your notes on formatting this are very useful. It could be 1A, 1B, or numbers, but they do need to be clearly designated at a glance. You could know that they are somewhat different. As you go down the pyramid, Commissioner Laverty, the next level is the residential resort optional, which is the RS2, which is basically a residential district, but again, there for reasons that we can go into or that I can go into with you when we get to these specific districts, it appears that there's no reason not to allow bed and breakfasts and things like that that might be resort-oriented. And so those areas allow another category of non-residential activity that the others do not.
Could you give me an example of neighborhood scale commercial facility as opposed to a non-neighborhood scale commercial facility?
Yes. A neighborhood scale facility, first of all, it would be limited in square footage. So, for example, probably nothing more than 2,500 square feet for use. But it's by scale, the size, and then by activity. These are activities that you would think of as everyday needs. At a convenience store or a general store, for example, or an ice cream shop, things of that nature, cumulatively very limited as to the acreage that they could occupy. And when we go to the individual zones, you'll see that we have capped the acres within the development areas that could be used for these purposes. Non-residential would be a supermarket, a small-scale community shopping center, factory outlet stores, things that you would expect that there would be, you wouldn't have in every neighborhood, but that it would be more properly situated at Rockwood or in Greenville, for that matter, or in a resort that is trying to be somewhat self-contained.
Thank you.
Then finally, at the bottom of the pyramid, the district that would be most open, the zone that would be most open to a variety of uses would be the resorts themselves, to give the greatest amount of flexibility to build in the attractions and the facilities necessary to make those resorts successful. And that would become part of long-term development plans that you would review in advance of a specific subdivision development review permit.
In terms of the scale of development allowed there, particularly commercial activity, there's been some discussion of golf courses. Could a golf course be considered appropriate for a resort zone?
Yes.
Let's say a commercial water park, an amusement park facility.
Good, great questions, because we had this very conversation, and the answer is no, not the way we have recommended the language. They have to be nature-oriented, and things like amusement parks would probably be either implicitly or maybe explicitly not allowed, unless you wanted it, but that's our recommendation.
Okay.
Yeah, our recommendation with respect to the resort-related zones is to allow for an intensity of development that accommodates nature-based resort development and the amenities that are associated with that, but that limits the types of uses to those that are nature-based, meaning, not an amusement park.
So that would that be a review criteria at the subdivision review stage?
Right. It would be embedded into the list of permitted uses for that zone. And the way I'm envisioning it is that the purpose of that zone would make it very clear that we are specifically talking about nature-based resort-related development. And you can refer to the footnote on page 50, footnote 56, to give you a list of examples that we had in mind when we were thinking of what the term nature-based resort-related might include.
I'd just like to make a comment that I'm I really appreciate this approach. I've always been concerned that when we've accepted plans, we've accepted subdivisions, not communities. And I think this gets us a long way toward creating community of various sizes in various places. So